You're listening to Guerrilla Radio, a companion to the Guerrilla History Podcast. I'm your host for today, Henry Huckamacki, one of the usual hosts of Guerrilla History, and also a member of the Guerrilla History Partisan Brigade. Now, you may be asking yourself, what is Guerrilla Radio? I have not heard of such a thing before. What is the Partisan Brigade? Well, I'm happy to introduce that this is a spin-off of Guerrilla History. Those of you who listen to Guerrilla History would have noticed that recently we had a panel discussion on why political education and historical knowledge are key to activism and organizing. And we had so much fun with the panel and had many discussions privately with the panel that we had for that discussion that we decided at Guerrilla History that these people needed their own show. And so that's what Guerrilla Radio is. It's a spinoff where this group of people, which we're dubbing the Partisan Brigade, will be able to host their own conversations, their own discussions, because they all have so much to give to us. So what we have today is an introduction to the spinoff show, Guerrilla Radio. And we have some members of the Partisan Brigade, pretty much anybody that we could scare up at this moment. So I'll have them introduce themselves now. We may have people flowing in or out as this introductory episode goes along, but we have a really, really great list of people who are on the Partisan Brigade. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes from this project. So the first person that I'd like to have introduce themselves is Matt. Matt, please go ahead and tell the listeners who you are.
Thank you, Henry. My name is Matt Deitch. I am 25 years old from Parkland, Florida. I am an organizer and a filmmaker. Short bios are difficult. I was a co-founder of March for Our Lives and the chief strategist, head of content, creative, and organizing. Then after that, I was an advisor for Bernie in 2020 on gun violence and youth issues. And since then, I've been doing organizing with Dream Defenders, Friends of Swazi Freedom, a bunch of different academic work, political education work, and still doing voter registration with organizations like Headcount, and doing artist education in prisons through Creative Acts. So yeah, and now today I am mostly a filmmaker, organizer, and student. I'm studying research into political economy through Ideas. And yeah, and I'm excited to be a co-host on here. So that's my intro.
Absolutely. I was very happy to connect with you back when we first did, Matt, and I'm really happy that we can have you on for this project. We're also joined by Shetta. Shetta, can you let the listeners know who you are?
Hi, everyone. So my name is Shetta. It was really good enunciation, by the way, Henry.
I do my best.
It was really, really good. I usually get Shatha, so Shetta was like on the nail. But my name is Shetta. I'm a Palestinian refugee from the Nakba in 1948. I'm an organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement. And my primary focus has been political education and trying to institutionalize knowledge, essentially, due to the way that the settler project works and trying to erase anything that is Palestinian, trying to reframe what is happening. So it's kind of propaganda, kind of political education at the same time.
Yeah, and Shetta is one of our most eloquent and radical voices in the young Palestinian activist arena. And so I'm very happy that Shetta agreed to be part of this project. And I'm really happy to be able to do things with you, Shetta. It's really a pleasure. Somebody who I've done other things with in the past, including an episode of Guerrilla History, is Mira. Mira, hello. Can you let the listeners know who you are?
Yeah, thank you, Henry. My name is Mira. I am one of the co-chairs of the Middle East and Africa subcommittee of the DSA International Committee. I work with, many comrades in the IC on formulating DSA's international positions and doing political education and creating relationships with, other anti-war organizations and movements overseas. So it's a broad swath of work, but very excited to be a part of this group of comrades and excited for the work that we're going to be doing going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really appreciate the work that Mira does on the DSA International Committee, which is, well, really one of the, what I think is one of the shining lights of DSA. There's definitely some parts, and this is, you know, I might as well say something that'll get some people mad in our introductory episode. There's definitely some parts of DSA that could use some reform, let's say. The DSA International Committee, on the other hand, is one of the places that does not need a change. It just needs more engagement from people outside of DSA International Committee and DSA more generally. They really do some great work. So thank you for that, Mira. We're also being joined now by my friend, Mikey. Hello, Mikey. We've had you on Guerrilla History before, and I'm really happy to see that you'll be a member of the Partisan Brigade for Guerrilla Radio as well. Can you let the listeners know who you are?
Yeah, hello. Yeah, thanks so much for having us. I'm Mikey. I'm a member of the Oahu Water Protectors and the Shutdown Red Hill Mutual Aid Collective, both of which are organizing around shutting down Red Hill, which is a massive Navy facility built in World War II that contains still over 100 million gallons of fuel, just 100 feet above our sole source aquifer that provides water to 500,000 people on this island. And in late 2021, thousands of people were poisoned. And so we are trying to get justice and accountability for those people, but also are part of kind of the broader movement in Hawaii to completely demilitarize and deoccupy Hawaii because it is illegally occupied by the U.S. And I'm really excited to be one of the co-hosts of Guerrilla Radio because it will be a great opportunity for me to bring on some Kanaka voices to speak about Native Hawaiian history, both past, present, and future. So very excited for that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a topic that we've been wanting to talk more about on Guerrilla History. I know that we still will talk about that on Guerrilla History, but I'm very glad that Mikey is going to step up and lead some of these conversations on Guerrilla Radio, and then we can kind of debrief him on the main show of Guerrilla History. So we also have, well, four or five other people that are going to be members of the Partisan Brigade and hosting their own segments of the show who are not able to be with us right now. But I do know that a couple of them will be joining as they become free. So we'll have them introduce themselves as they come on. What I want to say before I open the floor to everybody is that, you know, you may be hearing my voice now and think, oh, great, it's another show that Henry is hosting. Like, I hear enough of him on Guerrilla History. Don't worry, people. I am actually not hosting this show. I'm going to be producing it. I might sit in and help people if they need it. But really, this is the show for the people of the Partisan Brigade to, you know, shine, to show what they know, to have these conversations that they think are important, and to teach you, the listeners. I'm just here for this introductory episode and because I get to hang out with people that I really like. So just don't worry about that. You're not going to hear that much of my voice on Guerrilla Radio. Don't unsubscribe yet. I guess that one of the first things that I want to talk about with everybody is, what are some of the things that we're hoping to talk about on the show? Because I know, you know, Guerrilla History, I don't want to say we're constrained, because history is, I mean, it's huge. You can talk about almost anything and draw historical parallels. And so the context of it being a history program is not really constraining, but it is sometimes a little bit difficult to try to fit things to fitting within historical context. Whereas Guerrilla Radio can talk about history, but we can also talk about anything else that we find to be relevant and that we think that people should be knowing more about. And so this show really is a little bit more free, and having the broad variety of backgrounds of the hosts of this show, we'll be able to have certain insights that we are really unable to have on Guerrilla History. So I know, Mikey, you mentioned having some Kanaka voices on Guerrilla Radio. I guess I'll start with you. What are some things that you're hoping to accomplish with this project? What are some conversations that you're hoping to have with this? What are some things that you're hoping to convey to the listeners that they may not hear in other places?
Yeah. Oh, so many things. And I think, well, as a descendant of Japanese and Korean settlers in Hawaii, I think, like, people hear a lot more from people like me than they would generally from Native Hawaiians who, you know, are of this place and who have a lot of really important knowledge to share about not just current tensions and ongoing events, but how that all connects to the broader history throughout colonization, but also pre-colonization. And I'm really excited to kind of get more of a broader audience like the one you have with Guerrilla History to be able to speak to current issues, but how that connects to U.S. imperialism in Hawaii, but also to show that there are existing kind of like movements that are going on in parallel, so that we're not just viewing things in kind of like this negative perspective, right? Where like indigenous lifeways are something that used to exist as opposed to something that are continuing to be practiced by indigenous people who are still around, right? And I think for especially a lot of people on the continent, even though many people in the US, you know, live around other indigenous communities on indigenous land, they seem to have a hard time connecting to those histories or those movements, I think primarily because they don't have enough interest or genuine solidarity to seek them out. I think in Hawaii, it's a lot harder to ignore, but it is a lot easier to ignore for people who live on the continent who broadly, unfortunately, view these islands as kind of like a place to dump, you know, all of your trauma that you experience under capitalism to have your paradise vacation. So I'm really hoping that this is an opportunity for people to learn about, kind of like the movement for sovereignty in Hawaii from the people most actively engaged in it, and also a lot of the ongoing struggles, I think also, and how that connects with kind of the history leading into U.S. empire in the Pacific, because I think that is like a really important story that isn't really in many of the broader international left's conversations, that I think is kind of critically important to understanding how the United States became kind of like the world capitalist hegemon, and how that connects with, you know, places like Puerto Rico and Guam and Korea, and basically all of Asia.
Yeah, terrific. Mira, I'll turn to you next. I know that you do a lot of work on DSA International Committee, and so I know that you have a lot of connections and a lot of topics that you really do focus on with the work that you do there. I'm curious as to what you see, what you're bringing to Guerrilla Radio in terms of what the focus is going to be. What are some of the things that you're trying to get across? So I'd like to hear more about, you know, what do you see being your focus on the show?
Thanks. Well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of opportunities with this show to explore things in a more conversational style and in more depth than, for instance, we're able to do in a more of a formal panel setting, usually when we have, you know, several speakers who are, you know, experts in their field and are, you know, presenting their viewpoints on a particular perspective. And there may be a little bit of time at the end for audience questions or for a bit of conversation. But I think that this venue will allow for kind of, as Mikey was saying, tying together some of these elements of, you know, we often hear about situations in individual countries. You know, obviously the Middle East and Africa is an enormous area with, you know, many different crises and conflicts happening in different countries. U.S. imperialism is intertwined with nations across both regions. And to be able to tie these things together and kind of look at some of the more big picture elements, you know, how the conflict in Ukraine ties to, you know, what's going on in Syria, how Turkey fits into the overall equation, the centrality of the question of Palestinian liberation to the entire region of the Middle East, you know, and to movements throughout the region. So I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities to explore things in more depth. And I'm excited also to collaborate, you know, with the other members here of the Partisan Brigade, who have their own connections. And it'll be really interesting to see, you know, what kind of interesting conversations we can create together, I think, with a variety of guests. So that's sort of what I'm excited to explore in more depth.
Yeah, fabulous. Now, Shetta, I'm going to turn to you next. And I know that I'm sure that many of the conversations that you have are going to be focused on Palestine, as you really are somebody that is very deeply invested and very knowledgeable about the subject. But I also know that you have, you know, deep knowledge and passion and conviction about many other topics as well. And I've seen that. And I really do appreciate, you know, you putting your voice out there and speaking on many of these issues. So I want to hear, you know, what are some of the angles that you want to talk about with regards to Palestine on the show? Because, you know, I know that you're going to be really bringing a lot to the show in that regard. But also, are there any other things that you really have a deep passion for that you plan on discussing on the show, either by yourself or with guests?
So I basically live, breathe, eat Palestine. But the thing about Palestine, the Palestinian struggle, is that everything is connected. The way that American imperialism impacts Palestine in the same way that it impacts Hawaii and so on and so forth. So it's connected to everything. But what's, I think, interesting talking about Palestine is not only is anything you say censored, silenced, you're also criminalized and you're also penalized. So I find it super important to, whenever you have the opportunity, to challenge these narratives. Because anything that challenges the colonial project in the slightest is deemed a threat that needs to be shut down immediately. So I want to be able to unpack and contextualize what's been happening. For example, the far-right government that's been elected, a lot of people think that it's some kind of, you know, horrific reactionary sudden thing when this is deeply ingrained in the fascist Zionist project. And it's just coming to fruition as they get more and more reactionary. You're just able to see it. Talk about history. A lot of Palestinian history has been purposely erased, or, you know, an alternative narrative has been placed there, which is kind of what the entire Zionist project is based on. And also challenge the narratives that is so ingrained in the West. The way that Zionism and American imperialism are intertwined, it's institutionalized in policy and academia, like in every sphere of your life. So I just want to be able to kind of approach it from different angles, but also connect it to different struggles as well. And I'm so happy and excited to be with all these amazing people here and be able to talk with them about everything that they have to bring too.
Well, I'm very excited for all of those conversations. I'm looking forward to learning a lot from them myself. Now, Matt, you are somebody like me who has a very broad group of interests. I know that when I see what you're discussing, it's always like, oh, Matt's talking about this today. Matt's talking about that today. It's like almost like a shotgun approach to interest, but you always speak with very deep knowledge on all of the topics that I see you discussing. So it's something that I appreciate is that, you know, while you certainly have some topics that you focus on more than others, you really are, you know, wise beyond your years. And I can say that because I think I'm not sure if there's anybody else that's younger than me here. There might be. I know I'm a lot younger than people think that I am. But Matt, what are you planning on discussing on the show? What are your going to be primary interests that you see coming? Is there anything else that you would like to discuss that, you know, you're thinking that you might want to talk about?
Well, thank you for that, Henry. It's very kind. Just to be included in this group is inspirational. I'm sure many people can relate to feeling politically lost at times. So to be surrounded by people who are on the same page, being dedicated to anti-imperialist efforts at this day and age is very important. So that's just the first thing that I think ties all of us together. One of the major things that ties all of us together is the fight for a better world. But yeah, it's like, for me, my story starts with losing someone I knew to gun violence. And when you see someone younger than you, right, like in an open casket, that changes your life. And many people can relate to that. But when you understand that change is possible, and you start trying to figure out how to change things, and things aren't changing or things are getting worse, you start changing your tactics. And so for me, it was like, okay, we're going to start with gun reform. And then you see gun reform is tied to the military industrial complex, which is tied to empire and capitalism. And in the spaces I was in before that were liberal gun violence prevention spaces, where I was able to make a big impact, change the rhetoric, change the priorities, organizes differently, prioritize survivors over a lot of the people who are taking up a lot of space, make it less white, more pro-Black, which was very important. But so many times when I brought up how the guns that were coming to the United States or the guns that the United States was exporting are spreading violence everywhere, and that we had chapters from, and when I was at the head of March for Our Lives, we had 100 chapters outside the United States, and the organization didn't want to work with them specifically because of liability issues within tax code and nonprofit stuff. So the nonprofit governance structure was getting in the way of us organizing what could have been an international struggle against gun violence, which is what we understand is to be required. And so that issue, that those contradictions led me further and further away from liberalism, from electoral politics, towards something that was more grassroots, rooted in the people, rooted in actual freedom, liberation struggles. And so what I talk about is all the different things that intersect into this. So when it comes to organizing, political education, I'm into art. I think art is a way of transcending language. So for me, language is how we construct the world. If we're going to build a better world, we need better language. We need to be able to talk about these things. So to me, visual images are all that. Something I left out of my intro because I'm tired and it's been a long day already, but I'm also an organizer with Progressive International. And so breaking out of the U.S., the U.S. organizing spaces, I'm still invested deeply in grassroots organizing in the United States, but I also lend a lot of my resources to international struggles. And so, like I mentioned, Friends of Swazi Freedom, but with Progressive International, we were doing work to try to support the Chilean new constitution. We were supporting Lula, and supporting what was going on this week, the response to what was going on this week, not supporting what was going on this week, but, yeah. So, and then another thing I am is, by someone who believes in, if you believe in revolution, you believe in redistribution. So, that's why a big reason why I'm studying economics is specifically to come up with these models of redistribution, that will work long term. So, yeah, like one of the things I am doing is I'm a fundraising, I hate the word consultant, like fundraising advisor for this Solidarity Center in Puerto Rico. And that work is tied to local climate justice work, national freedom and liberation struggles, and the international anti-imperialist efforts. And so when we're talking about connecting everything back to Palestine, the colonization of Puerto Rico and Palestine are happening around the same times, the same years, the same technology for similar reasons is start to take over entire regions of the earth and extract natural resources, or rare earth metals, all these things for the empire. And so, yeah, those are the things I want to talk about. My thing is when I have an open prompt like this, I'm going to use it to have the conversations that I have been waiting to have with people, the things I'm going to use this as an excuse to have those conversations. I've made so many different friends and met so many inspiring people around the world. And anyone I know is also available to any of my fellow Partisan Brigade co-hosts. If we want to get anyone on anyone's episode, for sure, we should talk about that stuff, because my whole thing is making unique conversations happen, unique groups of people meeting each other. We're a unique group of people, and we're able to have different conversations, create a unified movement is the whole thing. So I just want more people coming together on, I want people who meet on our podcast episodes to do incredible work outside of the podcast, and also the podcast to be incredible work that inspires more people.
Well, Matt, you summarized what the whole point of the show was better than I could have. So, you know, what am I even doing here? I should just had you lead from episode one. We are now joined by another member of the Partisan Brigade. We have James, who has come in. James is one of my best friends, so I'm very glad to see that James has come in. So, James, can you tell the listeners who you are briefly, you know, what are some of the things that you're involved in? And then also the question that I've been going around and asking everybody is, what are some of the topics that you in particular are really looking forward to having on this show? What are some of the things that you want to make sure that the listeners of the show are exposed to that they may not otherwise be exposed to, at least from the perspective that we're trying to bring to them?
Sure. Hi, everybody. My name is James Ray. I am a part of the steering committee for the BDS Working Group in DSA, as well as a member of the Philadelphia Young Communist League. Most of the organizing I do is geared towards international issues, primarily Palestine. I apologize. There's a little bit of noise in the background. There's some construction going on, as there usually is in Philly. But yeah, most of the stuff I organize around is usually around either Palestine housing rights or labor, particularly in Philadelphia. We've had a lot of labor around Starbucks unions and Ultimo Coffee. So that's kind of what I've been delving the majority of my time into as of late. I'm really excited about this, though. Personally, this entire project to me is going to be really fun. People who know me, people who know me well, like all of y'all, know that I am painfully ADHD and have a very eclectic amount of knowledge on a lot of random things. So having an open-ended way to talk about that to other people is kind of like a blessing for me. It means I probably will annoy a lot of y'all a lot less about random things like fishery politics in the global south, or you know, like Palestinian liberation is mostly what I think I gear a lot of my education towards. The last couple of years for me personally, I spent a lot of time, particularly in college, studying comparative genocide studies, and a lot of that had to go into learning a lot of going into a lot of rabbit holes. Essentially, I think the thing about is particularly genocide studies in the history of human rights, and particularly as it pertains to the West, is that there is so much information and so many things to delve into, especially from a Marxist lens, that so much of like academia, I think, is thoroughly lacking, that you have unlimited information to essentially learn constantly. And as I delved more into a lot of that, as well as like my what started as an interest due to a close friend of mine turned into a bit more of a personal passion regarding Palestinian liberation, I just have a lot of things to talk about. And it's really exciting for me to be able to ramble to a captive audience. Something about that seems very fun. But, you know, what I'll probably primarily be discussing is settler colonialism as it pertains to the settler colonial project of Israel, as well as the United States. Those are the things I know the most about. I might do local Philly politics from here and there. So if you hear me talking about anything going on in Philadelphia, it's probably just because I'm on the ground and I'm irritated about something I saw that day. Those of you who probably know me from Philadelphia on the ground, a lot of the stuff I do is geared towards like protest events, as well as crisis pregnancy center counter-protesting, which is super fun because pro-life people are crazy. So yes, that's a lot of what I do, and that's what I'm excited to talk about. So thanks for having me on, I guess.
Yeah, outstanding. So I know that there's one or two more members of the Partisan Brigade who may pop in the next couple of minutes. We'll see. But before I ask the next question, which I'll just open up to everybody to opine on, I just want to say that, as you can see, listeners, the variety of topics that we're talking about, they all fit within that anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist lens, but the variety of topics is very broad. Even within one individual, there's a broad variety of topics that they're interested in having conversations about. And between the hosts, there's an incredible amount of variety that we're hoping to see on the show. I know one thing that we're planning on doing with Guerrilla History is and I haven't really discussed this with any of you. I've talked about it with one or two of the other members of the Partisan Brigade. But, you know, if you're having continued conversations about a given topic, let's say, for example, one of our members is planning several episodes on Puerto Rico. When they have several episodes on Puerto Rico, let's say 3 or 5 episodes on related topics regarding Puerto Rico, either Puerto Rican history or things that are going on now, we will then be able to bring that individual from the Partisan Brigade onto Guerrilla History and do a debrief of the things that we're learning on Guerrilla Radio. So a nice way to kind of cross-pollinate between the two shows, but also to kind of condense, summarize the knowledge that we're learning with this show in a shorter form on Guerrilla History. So I really like the idea that we have this variety of hosts with the variety of expertise and a variety of interests, and the ability for any of these individuals to go in and dive as deep into a given topic as they want. James, you can talk about fisheries as much as you want. I give you free rein over fishery politics. But, you know, when we have those conversations, as we have repeated conversations on similar topics, we'll be able to debrief you and condense that in a way for the Gorilla History listeners as well to understand some of the things that we're learning through this project. So I really look forward to it being a very collaborative effort between our side on guerrilla history, your side as members of the Partisan Brigade, things that you're doing together. I really think that the ability to work with each other is going to be able to link a lot of our struggles together, link a lot of our expertise together, and enable us to understand the world in a better way and understand what actions need to be taken in order to change the way that we would like to see. The next question that I have that I just want to pitch out there, I'm curious. I think that we actually talked about this on the Guerrilla History episode a little bit, but how all of you got interested in politics. So, you know, the people that are listening to this podcast inevitably are going to be political junkies, kind of like all of us. So everybody has their own, let's say, origin story. But obviously, the experiences and the exposures that we've had throughout our lives are what shape who we are, and they shape our outlook on the world. So I'm curious as to how each of you came to the ideological and outlook that you have, the way that you view certain events, the way that you view history. I know that we all have, you know, somewhat similar ideologies, perhaps not exactly the same, but I want to know, how did we reach that point? Because I think that it might also give us a little bit of insight into the kind of things that we're all interested in and the things that we can kind of push for further understanding with the show. So whoever wants to go, feel free to hop in. It was just a general idea for somebody to hop in on.
Okay. So I'm just going to talk about a little bit about what politicized me or kind of took me down this journey. I think being a Palestinian, being a refugee, being quote unquote stateless, really from a young age politicized me, because I didn't really understand why I was a refugee, but I didn't even have a country that I could go back to. Like most refugees are, they're in a transition outside due to natural disaster or war, what have you, but they have a home, and I had nothing. And growing up too, I'd always listened to my grandparents' stories about the Nakba, and all of the horrific things that they endured, escaping that ethnic cleansing. So I've always been connected to Palestine. I've always been connected to, the struggle back home. But I think in the recent years, I've been able to kind of go down the trajectory of the Palestinian left, specifically with the PFLP, and being able to connect the struggle through imperialism, and how that intersects, like, collectively. So I think I've always been politicized, but the trajectory I've been down now is specifically because of my introduction to the Palestinian left. And like George Habesh, Leila Khaled, Ghassan Kanafani, that's really, really shaped my politics.
And Shedda, I know that we've already discussed talking about these things on Guerrilla History. I am still going to hold you to that, putting it on tape now so that you can't squirm out of it. You can't back out. We are going to have these conversations on Guerrilla History as well. So be prepared.
So my politicization didn't really come from any personal family history. I think it came more from probably the Trump election. I used to say that I was radicalized by Bernie, but I don't think that's quite accurate. I think I was radicalized by Trump, and not so much the fact that he represented a system that was broken so much as a system that had reached a certain apotheosis, a certain kind of point of absurdity, that, you know, second time is farce, you know, where I started off kind of as like a Daily Show liberal. And then I realized, like, oh, wait, something had to have happened here in order for us to get this clown president, right? And in order for, you know, one of the most major establishment candidates in the Democratic Party to get what was basically like the most slam dunk election probably in our lifetimes, and to lose it that hard. and that something else was at work there. And that's when I started getting into studying, you know, communism, revolutionary movements, kind of slowly coming to terms with social democracy as a dead end, but then also kind of realizing that a lot of the things that had happened kind of like in plain sight all around me, pretty much my entire life being born and raised in Hawaii, was something that I need to be directly invested and involved in, and to kind of like own whatever kind of like complicity, you know, particularly Asian settlers and my family in particular, played in, you know, the ongoing displacement of Native Hawaiians and the destruction of this Aina. And that kind of led to my organizing personally, leading to the Stand on Mauna Kea in 2019, where I was invited by Kanaka Comrade to come up and hold space there. And I figured like one of the best things that I could contribute is alternative media. So I brought my camera with me and ended up spending about 100 days there total. And that kind of changed my whole life and really broadened my perspective and a lot of the relationships that I have today. A lot of close ones were made on the Mauna. And so that's kind of how things transitioned into the Red Hill organizing that I'm now engaged in.
So for me, I think it was a series of events that really led to me kind of, I think, radicalizing more so than anything. I grew up in a very political household. My father was always extremely political. And I remember growing up having pretty much constant conversations regarding like things like economics, basic politics, et cetera, given very skewed views of those things as my family is to have. But I think it brought me up in a position, even when I was young, where I was kind of keenly interested in political stuff. Going through high school and early college, I was a lot more liberal than I am now, to put it lightly. You know, my first real kind of like political, the first thing that I really bought into was the Sanders campaign in 16. And I think like a lot of us, it kind of led me down a rabbit hole. You know, it went from like, oh, I think free healthcare is cool to like, oh, like this system's fundamentally corrupt through a series of other like secondary things. You know, like post 2016, I ended up in college in a small state school before I transferred to Purdue. In Southern Kentucky, Murray State, and really fun school. One of the guys I ended up meeting there was a Palestinian student who lived in East Jerusalem. And he basically told me what were a lot of like horror stories coming out of the occupation. And, you know, my close friendship with him, coupled with what I was hearing, led me, I think, to start questioning the nature of the state in which we exist, given that state, from my understanding at the time, pretty much, you know, both parties were in full support of the Zionist project. And, you know, that, I think, started me down the road, I think, more than anything. And then, you know, in 2018, I went abroad, basically, to study Eastern European relations in the post-Yugoslavian and Soviet spheres with the EU. And kind of the history and development of the Balkans in particular. And I remember distinctly that the moment it kind of clicked, I think, was I had studied genocide in college. And when I moved, you know, when I was over there, I visited Bosnia for a span of about a week and a half. And a majority of the time I was there, I was in Sarajevo. Which is a beautiful city, a war-torn city, but very beautiful. And the people are some of the nicest people I've ever met in my entire life. And on my way to Belgrade in Serbia, we stopped in Srebrenica in what's today known as Republika Srpska in eastern Bosnia. And visiting the memorial site of the genocide that had occurred in Srebrenica in the 90s, and then talking to the curator. For those of you who don't know, the genocide memorial in Srebrenica has a whole section basically outlining why the Clinton administration was complicit, and outlining like why the Clinton administration kind of let it happen. And watching that in the museum and then talking to the curator and saying, and him saying like, yeah, we don't like them even getting near here is like something we don't appreciate. Like US politicians coming here is something they don't like. Really, I think, made me reevaluate the idea that there was really a party that was redeemable in a lot of ways, right? This idea, like, I think especially growing up and being more liberal in my early life, I always held on to this kind of like democratic socialist belief that like, oh, internally through electoral change, it's more social, in my personal was like, oh, you know, we can hang on to this electoral change. We can really, I think one of these parties can be reformed in such a way that like is actually going to be, I think, viable for like the overall overhaul of like an entire system. And it led me to be more, I think, pessimistic. And then I came home and COVID hit, which was not really a great way to, I think, reinforce what was already a growing pessimism. And at that point, you know, I kind of was like at the end of my college career and said to myself, like, okay, like, what the hell are we going to do? What is stopping me from just like at this point, just giving up? And I think at the right time, was introduced to a series of books that really, I think when I read them, I said, this makes sense. And it was all like Fanon initially and then Lenin. And so I was reading like Lenin's analysis and like State and Rev. And then what the first book I read actually that was leftist theory was Wretched the Earth. And reading Wretched the Earth, I was like, oh shit. Yeah, this checks out. Like reading through it, I was like, this makes a lot of sense to me. It's actually Rev Left, I think, or it was either Rev Left or Guerrilla History with the podcast that got me to buy it. So I had listened to y'all's podcast for a while and I had been like, okay, these guys make sense to me. They don't sound crazy. Because like where I was from in Indiana, like the general stereotype was the communists are fucking nuts. So I was like, oh yeah, these guys sound normal. This is really cool. I like these guys. And then I read Wretched of the Earth and I was like, wow, I actually want to burn the whole system down, which I think is the reaction most of us have. And after that, I kind of just kept reading and kept doing organizing and meeting the right people at the right time. I mean, quarantine was beautiful for meeting other communists because we were already all terminally online and just it made it worse. We got to network a lot and that's where I've met a lot of people from that end. So that's, I guess, my little story. I'm sorry I ramble, but that's, I guess, how I got here.
All right. I guess I'm up next. Wow. This is like causes me to go back decades. I'm significantly older, I think, than everyone else here. Let's see. Well, I am, like Mikey, I grew up in Hawaii. On my mom's side, we have both Japanese and Portuguese settlers to the islands. So I come from a very multicultural background. My dad is an immigrant from Iran. And I grew up kind of always aware of, you know, the impact of U.S. and Western imperialism to some extent on the rest of the world. My parents are leftists. My mom was a Vietnam era protester. So I was sort of steeped in that as a child. And then we traveled to Sri Lanka when I was about 14. And I think at that point I became kind of fascinated with, you know, why were these enormous disparities in wealth occurring between the country that I had grown up in the United States and what I was seeing, you know, in Sri Lanka? What were the patterns of history that established that? And that I became interested in, international affairs in a academic sense. So that was what my undergraduate studies were in. And I, you know, focused on African development, spent a semester in Tanzania, which sort of just further solidified my understanding of the patterns of extraction that came, you know, under the period of colonialism and, you know, have continued into the present, with imperialism and neocolonialism. And, you know, read Fanon, like many of you have, which really radicalized me. And I would say probably by the time I was 19 or so, I had become a communist, but, you know, didn't really have a lot of outlets for that in terms of, you know, what I was doing with my life. So more recently, becoming involved with the DSA International Committee has allowed me to kind of put that all into practice. I also have a master's in public administration that was also internationally focused. So that's kind of my academic background. And then ideologically, you know, I've been pretty far left. And I think continuing to move further left as the years go by, really want, you know, to help other Americans, I think, make that similar ideological journey to, you know, challenging some of the narratives of history that they are fed. And their understanding of the world, you know, to create a better world going forward.
Yeah, it's a hard question for me to answer because it's always, where do you start the story? So I guess for me, I'm going to start when I was conscious of my politics for the first time, which is when I was 20. We at March for Our Lives did Road to Change, where we traveled around the country. We did 100 cities in 63 days, and I was on a bus for the entire summer. And I did, like, not everyone did all the activities. I did every single thing we had signed up, like, we had organized on the tour. And a lot of it was really heavy. A lot of it was meeting with survivors from different tragedies involving gun violence, not gun violence, just all different types of things. We went to the border and met with people who were dealing with all the stuff there. We went to an ICE facility in Homestead, which is one of the more horrific ICE facilities in the country. Went inside prisons in California. And it was just a summer of, like, we were in Ferguson, we were in Standing Rock, we were in so many different places where you're just seeing America, or the U.S. You're seeing the U.S. and you're seeing what it actually is. And all the things that I'd been taught were falling apart in front of me, and the cognitive dissonance to continue doing things the way that we were doing was tearing, I think, all of us apart in different ways. And so at the end of the tour, the second to last day of the tour, we ended the tour at Sandy Hook in Connecticut, in Newtown. And the day before, we were in New York City, and I got to meet with Harry Belafonte. And Harry Belafonte gave me, I asked him, how do we win, was my question, because I was so tired from the summer. And I saw that we were going to win all these elections, but the people that we were electing, I was realizing, was we were voting out NRA people, but we were voting in the same people who had been in power before. A lot of these people had lost in the past, now they're winning again. And they're all taking corporate money that gets in the way of them doing anything that would materially help people. And I asked him how we win. And he loved my question, and we became like quick friends. And he gave me Wretch of the Earth. And I read it. It took me a year to read it because I had gone through a lot that previous year, and reading was really difficult. But once I got through it, I felt less crazy. Like, I felt like I was like things had started to open up. And so I traced Fanon, and I read Discourse on Colonialism, and I read some Lenin, and then through Lenin, Marx and Engels, and then from there, like, Ho Chi Minh. And I just found these thinkers who were saying that the thing that was so interesting to me was, my whole life I was told to ignore these thinkers, and you're told in school not to engage their writing because they're crazy or whatever. And one of the things that it motivates me the most, or gets me the most mad actually, is when people try to bring me into their delusions. And there's nothing more delusional than capitalism and like colonialism. And when people are rationalizing it around you, sometimes they don't realize that's what they're doing. A lot of times they don't realize that's what they're doing. But I feel like I had like the map, like I could actually connect all the dots when the people around me were choosing not to. So that was a big part of it, those readings and the self-study. But it was also a lot of individuals. I think, I don't know if y'all can relate to this, but for me, like, if I didn't have certain people who were taking on like a mentorship role, basically, where I could turn to them and ask certain questions or get certain confirmations or just discussions, like, I wouldn't have been able to get to where I am today. And those people are like, there's Phil Agnew from the Dream Defenders, Aja Monet, the surrealist blues poet, like Austin from DSA. Like, it's just some really dedicated organizers who really care about people. But the thing I want to highlight the most is that I wouldn't have gotten to this point if it wasn't for the multi-generational nature of it. I had come into organizing and activism as a youth activist and organizer. And the mindset was the old people would have figured it out if they could have figured it out. So we got to figure it out without them. And we didn't want to talk to anyone over 30. And that was like our mindset. And it was so silly because you realize the limitations of that so quickly. The funniest moment for me was I start the organization. It's like 6 months after we start the organization, and I'm working with the chapters that are modeled after the thing that like I helped draw up, and the chapters turning to me and saying, I'm too old to tell them what to do. And I was like, I'm 20, like you're 16. Like we need to work together. And they were like, no, like the same mindset that I was using to isolate, or that we were all using to isolate ourselves away from a multi-generational political movement. But I think it also was because a lot of the adults that were coming to us were people without the answers. They were people who were representing Democratic big D interests. And we knew that that was a dead end. So we had to walk a line away from them. But a lot of people that I worked with ended up working with them. No, I mean, there's March for Our Lives people who work in Pelosi's office and the work for different members of Congress, right? Like Max Frost just got elected. Like there's people who are saying we need to work outside the system, but even the way they work outside the system is still attached to the system. And so I was happy to find people fighting their entire lives in an alternative way. And understanding that that struggle is hundreds of years old is both scary, but grounding. And it shows like our position and what we can actually accomplish and how potentiality always exists. And that's something that I don't think you learn or understand until you meet people who experience all the history that you're learning about, or parts of the history that you're learning about.
I know that we have one other member who's in the process of joining us right now. And just in the meantime, while they're coming in, I might as well just discuss the fact that I really think that we're going to get the opportunity to discuss a lot of regions that are not typically focused on in, you know, not only when I say Western media, I don't only mean the mainstream media. Even if you look at alternative media, there are certain regions that are definitely overrepresented in, you know, alternative, even somewhat progressive or left media. The United States is focused on very heavily, of course. Western Europe is focused on very, very heavily, of course. And then there's also, you know, some countries that get a lot of disproportionate coverage, or at least, you know, more coverage than other areas do, like China, for example. If it's liberal media, of course, the coverage is very negative. If it's left media, it's much more positive. But why is the coverage stopping at a place like China? Why aren't we focusing on other regions? You know, why is Palestine not focused on nearly as much in the media, even independent media, as it otherwise could be? I know somebody that actually I had been talking to and have been talking to, and we have an episode of Guerrilla History with, who I've been chatting with about this project and actually wants to be involved, is Comrade Booker from the Communist Party of Kenya. And I know everybody here really likes Comrade Booker, so, and I know he'll be listening to this. And of course, we'd love to have you involved, Comrade Booker. For those who are not familiar with him, he is the deputy chairperson of the National Communist Party of Kenya, and has been doing some incredible work both with the party, but also in terms of some, he's been starting to make some appearances in media, and he has so much to teach us. But even when you look at independent media, those sorts of voices are not granted the platform to be able to discuss things and teach us things, not only, you know, in terms of from their region. You know, not only is Booker able to teach us about Kenya, Booker has so much to teach us about everything. He's an incredibly smart person. And so this show, with the variety of interests that the hosts have, is going to enable us to look at different regions, bring guests on from different regions, have conversations about different regions, learn from these various areas, learn from people that are operating within these various areas, and connect our struggles with one another. The struggle within Kenya is not only against the bourgeois of Kenya. Kenya has been, you know, in the crosshairs of imperial powers for forever. So interlinking the struggles that those in the West have with people like Comrade Booker. And I'm just using him as a representative of, you know, something that I'm hoping happens with this show, because I talk with Booker sometimes about this. Linking these struggles together, this international solidarity and international collaboration within struggle, is something that is very, very important. Now, fortunately, we have been joined by another member of the Partisan Brigade. We have Sam joining us now. Sam, I'm going to have you do a few things because we've already been chatting for about an hour at this point. So I'm going to have you go through the topics that we've all been discussing. So first, tell the listeners who you are. Second, tell the listeners the sorts of things that you are hoping to discuss and bring to the limelight on Guerrilla Radio. And third, if you want to tell us about how you became politically aware, how you got engaged in politics, that would also be probably interesting. So just go ahead. I know that we've been blabbering on for an hour, and so now is your time to go as long as you want.
Hello, everyone. So I'm Sam. I definitely, if you follow me, you probably know I want to talk about Puerto Rico because it's really important to me. And it's kind of like where my political development started, especially like after Hurricane Maria and my family like losing a lot there. That was like kind of where I started. I was a Bernie girl in 2016. So that was kind of like where my at all being political really, really began for me. Although I always had parents who were like more like not just like left liberal leaning, always like more like democratic socialist type of leaning, whatever you want to call it. And so like I always came from that kind of background, but then I started to like get more interested in politics as like stuff started unfolding in Puerto Rico. And that was just kind of like where that all began. And then I would love to talk about Puerto Rico because I think it's really important. It's always something I'm looking to like find stuff about. And like, I'll go on like Spotify a couple years ago, I remember, and like just typing it in, and there's not a lot. So like, that was always something that I was interested in and want to talk about. And I forgot your last question there, Henry.
Well, you kind of tied them all together. Who are you? What do you want to talk about? And how did you get interested in these things? You hit it all. You got it.
I was like, I'm missing something, but yeah. So that's it. And then I don't know, just generally misogyny on the left, just because I it's been something I definitely deal with a lot. And I'm sure every woman on here deals with all the time.
Well, you know, I actually want to kick that topic back to you for a second. And then I know Mira and Sheda might have things that they would like to add to it. This is something that, of course, I note whenever I see people interacting with you on Twitter. And I know, right, what's your primary Twitter handle right now? Zuko's Mama, yes?
Yeah, that's.
That's the primary one. Okay, so whenever I see people interacting with you, the amount of misogyny is really insane. And this is not only true from anti-communists interacting with you, but even some people on the left that don't like certain things that you're saying, the misogyny comes out very quickly. And I know that this is something that I had mentioned on Twitter in a conversation, is that I would like to have this sort of conversation taking place in terms of why do we see this misogyny directed against communist women? Why do we see this misogyny directed against them, even by people that should be calling them comrades? I don't know. Perhaps you want to share a few insights or experiences that you've had on this. This is probably something that you'll want to talk more at length about in the future, like in a devoted episode to the topic. But, you know, what are some of your experiences that you've had with this?
No, it's definitely been like, it is like the first thing that people go to a lot of the time when they like interact with me online. It's interesting. A lot of the time too, it'll be like, I get a lot of like people addressing me as like, okay, lady and stuff like that. So it's always like that like undercurrent, but there are people who are like very overtly misogynistic to me. And even like for people like who are ostensibly on like the communist left, like I know probably everyone, if I say this username, everyone's gonna like make a face, but you know that like Pan-American communist whatever everyone's going to like be like, oh god, like he'll come after, like as someone who like believes in like event like sex trade abolition, he'll come after me and be like, well, you fucking do this, and I'm like, and I like have to because I have to pay fucking rent, like what do you want me to do, dude? Like it's not that I'm sitting here like supporting this, I'm not like on like some other whatever, but it's the assumption that because I do certain work that I approve it or whatever, which is one thing that I think drives a lot of misogyny my way. It comes from like part of the work that I do, which I don't ever really talk about. It's just in my bio. And then if I do talk about it, I'm like, oh, like I don't believe in this industry, blah, 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 blah. But it just gets like pinned on a lot of women who like do that work where it's like, oh, you do it, so you must support it. And that's really irritating because it's like, no, I do it because I am in school and I had to pay rent and I had no money in my account. And I was like, I don't know what to fucking do. And it is what it is. I had to do what I had to do. And so I think that drives a lot of misogyny, but it's also just like being a woman with opinions online is really offensive to some people. And that tweet I got like everyone really upset with was talking about how like men choose to subscribe to fascist ideology. We're like raised, like I was raised in a deeply like misogynistic culture because we all are, like, especially if you're raised in the United States. So like it's some of it just seeps into how people think and they don't even like think to challenge their thought process or think that they're being misogynistic because it's so baked into like our culture and how we interact with women that they just don't even see it. So I think that's a big part of it too, where they're just like, I'm not being misogynistic because this is just how they've always interacted with women. So it kind of like bleeds out. Yeah, it's definitely like the big thing is being a woman online, man, with my face. It is, it brings a lot of misogyny my way, but I've gotten a lot, like, it's gotten a lot easier to deal with, also though, cause it's just been years of dealing with it. And it's from every segment. Cause when I was like more liberal a couple of years ago, it was still from more liberal leaning people. So it really doesn't matter. And I think too, my account is positioned where I have enough of a following that a lot of people who are super misogynistic to me don't necessarily share my like body politic. I have a lot of people blocked at this point. My mentions have been like really comfortably quiet for the last 2 days. I'm like, did I finally get like the vast majority of the worst people? But it'll always come back. It'll always come back. But it's definitely a problem. And I can't pin it on like a particular segment. It is like everywhere you go. It doesn't matter if you're on the communist left, if you're an anarchist, if you're a liberal, whatever, there will always be misogyny. Even though liberals like to think that they're like the, you know, girl boss central, never been misogynistic in their life.
Yeah, I could talk about this a little bit. You know, I see so much of the misogyny directed towards Sam on the timeline, which is always really disappointing to see, you know, particularly from people who are ostensibly left themselves. I don't know what it is about me being a woman on the internet. I think particularly if you have your face out there and stuff, there's just a certain, you know, level of vitriol that gets directed towards you kind of automatically that doesn't seem to happen, I think, as readily with men, you know, and I've never been really sure how to deal with that. I mean, I think as a woman on the one hand, you know, there's a propensity for people to, you know, not engage with you or not take you seriously intellectually. And then I think if you stand up for yourself, especially online, I think it's also easy for people to think of you as a bitch. So I think it's kind of a bit of a double-edged sword for women. And I think the way that you can express yourself is also kind of narrowed in a way that often doesn't occur for men. So things that, you know, might not be critiqued for a man, I think oftentimes will invite a lot of criticism when a woman does it. So in that sense, I think it can be very limiting. I think like Sam, I've also sort of gotten used to it, unfortunately. You know, you sort of become tougher by just having to be in that rough and tumble online environment, and you learn to ignore a lot of it. But I think it also makes you censor yourself at times, you know, and like the full range of expression as a human being. I think women, you know, exposed to that kind of harassment have a tendency to kind of, you know, only portray aspects of themselves to the public that they think are less likely to invite that kind of negativity.
Yeah, no, on the internet, being a woman, like no matter what circle, is horrible. It's a big segment that's really creepy. Yeah. And they try to talk to you about certain topics as a way to hit on you. And it's just given me PTSD at this point because it keeps happening so many different times. And they're either on like two different spectrums where they're like, you know, women are all, I don't know if we can swear on this, but like women who do this and that are all like whores and sluts. And on the other hand, they're all like objectifying women. Like there's no, like be normal, like be a normal person. Yeah. You don't have to be these two opposite things. Like, I just block. I don't even engage. I know the same account that Sam mentioned, where Yada had posted a tweet disproving whatever bullshit they were saying. And his response was, oh, just a white woman. Like it always reduces to you being a woman. And then obviously, like, you know, a lot of the internet uses white women as like a punching bag to be progressive, but it's just misogyny at the end of the day.
Were you talking about when he said that about Tara?
But I remember Yara. I'm not sure about who's Tara too. Probably yeah. Something with Tara. He always attacked Palestinian women for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know what it was. He was like, you're a colonizer or something. Like that. She was like, what are you talking about? Like, but yeah, no, it's definitely I think that's a really good point that you bring up, Shata, about like some, and then there's the men who are like, no, I'm totally an ally to women, but they're like in your DMs. And especially like if you, like, I can't say especially, I guess, but in my case, because of like part of the work I do, then it gets into that realm. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on here? Like, you're reaching out to me in supposed solidarity, and all of a sudden you're soliciting me? Like, that's really gross and like fucked up. Too many that is like the case too. And then it's like, okay, so you're like the ally, except you're not. You're still like trying to like get something out of me. So like it can be really hard in some ways to trust certain people, where it's like, the minute I see a DM, I'm like, oh, come on. I don't want to even, I like you as a person. I don't want to know what's in the DMs right now, because I'm nervous about it. Like, it weirds me out. So it sucks. Like, it can suck. It can feel really like isolating. You don't know like who's like taking you seriously or not.
I feel like a lot of the backlash that Sam received was kind of like very insincere. Like, they were trying to like be misogynistic, but like dialectically or some bullshit, like trying to base it in some kind of material reality that doesn't exist. And Sam responded, I think quite appropriately, pointing out that, like, you know, like, even when you are empathetic to certain men in terms of their experience of alienation or being unable to meet certain impossible standards under patriarchy, they often don't respond in any kind of productive way, which is kind of really telling. But I think also telling is how a lot of these, you know, these people who claim some kind of left tendency on particularly the online left, they spend so much time kind of like placating and ministering to misogynists and like shitty men, thinking that that's like the reason why the left can't win. And it really, like, none of those people spend nearly as much time actually working with like, or organizing oppressed peoples. And so I think it really kind of reveals, like, you know, the fact that they spend so much time, like, disproportionately talking about how that's the problem of the left and that should be a priority, but so little time actually addressing, you know, like, kind of a broader alienation under capitalism, I think really shows that they're not really making any real argument. They're just trying to excuse misogyny, but from like a left lens, which is bullshit. And I think it's kind of like part of a broader trend, I think, of what we're seeing from it, kind of like that old Simpsons joke, you know, like, we've tried nothing and nothing works. It's people who like, they haven't had that moment where they're actually experiencing like the power, the potential power in community and organizing community. So they think that the only way to actually achieve liberation is to basically placate everyone's most reactionary tendencies, rather than to directly address them and work through them.
Yeah, I know, Matt, you might have something to add on this. I just wanted to say one quick thing in terms of framing misogyny dialectically. It calls to mind a quote that I had read. I don't remember who made the quote, and I don't remember exactly how the quote went, but it was something essentially, and perhaps one of you will know the quote that I'm referring to, and if you do, please jump in. It was something along the lines of, social chauvinists are always utilizing the phrase dialectics in order to reaffirm what they already believe, but with the guise of doing it, you know, in a dialectical fashion. So they will misuse dialectics, dialectical materialism, in order to, you know, push a certain narrative, and they'll use it basically as a smokescreen to hide the fact that they're really just pushing a certain narrative to begin with. And with regards to misogyny, you know, it reminds me of a certain website that claims that it speaks for world socialists, who will remain unnamed, but there is a certain website that speaks for world socialists. And they, you know, frequently will go out on misogynistic tirades, or will go out flat out for like rapist and sexual assault apologia on their website, but in quote unquote dialectical ways. And this is, you know, something that we see pretty frequently. And as Mikey pointed out, this is not something that we see from people that are actually serious about achieving a goal. This is not something that we see from people that are serious about the organizing work that that they do. This is people that are online, either trying to get likes on Twitter or get people to read their website devoted to world socialism. Again, an unnamed website that nobody certainly will be able to figure out what I'm talking about. But this is something that we see, and it really is a big problem. Matt, is there anything that you want to add on that topic?
Yeah, I appreciate the conversation, firstly, because I think it's stuff that like is usually said in like the void and not said in like longer form and like with more thought. So I appreciate that, firstly. But second, I say this a bunch, like in the United States, politics is thought to be something that you just like you think in private, or you whisper to your friends about, or like what you, it's like your beliefs or whatever, and not what you do, which is like a wild thing. And so people can claim left politics while not doing shit. And like, that's not having left politics. It's liberalism, maybe something even worse. So anyone who is for revolutionary organizing or for trying to build a better world and is just like yelling at Sam has no idea what they're doing. Like, it's just, I just think all the time about the energy trade-off, right? Like so many people are putting energy into just being shitty to each other. And it's like, it's not like, I understand that there's limited outputs for people, but a part of the work is knowing where to put your anger. And if a majority of people's anger is being put towards women, and I've seen it on the internet a ton, white women be used as like, you add that word, then all of a sudden it's okay to just be a piece of shit towards women in general or broadly. So yeah, it's the internet, like, it's not meant for that. Like it facilitates those types of harassment. I the only thing I can relate to is that I helped run the March for Our Lives account, and the amount of harassment and threats and everything we got on that was an absurd amount, in which we were spending so much time a day per day going through messages that no one should ever have to read. And then we brought it to like data analysis people, and they told us that the level of harassment we reach doesn't compare to like what the average woman user gets, and like so that just like scaled it for me like quantitatively. So that was something I was like, the sheer number of like tweets and DMs and things that are like targeted harassment towards like users, like social media users that are women, that are like publicly like identifying themselves as women, it's horrific. And like the people who, like the so-called left people who say that they are fighting for a better world and spend any time participating in that, pick up a book, touch grass, log off, delete your account. Like, I don't know what else to say to like that crowd. Because like, I don't know, I read this like the other day, like people use the manifesto to be like, oh, they see, like if we just work through class, like everything else figures itself out. And like, they don't read like the later works that sort of go back on that and say, hey, no, we got to work through this anti-Irish racism, and we got to work through this like anti-blackness and this kind of stuff. And they don't talk enough about it because the project's not done. You got to continue the project. So people who want to pull text to support their chauvinistic positions, as we were talking about, like they don't have a place in our movement, and they're trying to get us to grab Nazis. Like, that's absurd. Why are they the Nazi like advocacy league or whatever the fuck? Like, so that's what I got to say about all that. I could rant and ramble forever, but we got to find, I think even myself, especially myself and everyone else, like if you're a man who's in the left space, like being someone who is listening more and just like adapting your behavior, because you can't believe we grow up in a misogynistic, racist society and not think that some of that shit, if not a lot of that shit, seeps into your perceptions, and having to actively, like James was saying, actively unlearning is important. And the only way we can do that is with each other. So anyone who's swatting people down or not listening is suspect to me.
Yeah. As Matt said, we could probably rant on that topic or many other topics for very, very long. And I'm looking forward to those rants in the future, but we've been going for about an hour and a half already. We should probably wrap up because this is just an introductory episode. I'm really looking forward to everything that all of you members of the Partisan Brigade are going to be putting together. And I'm really looking forward to getting to edit the things and put it out there for people to listen to, including myself. I'm looking forward to learning from all of the conversations that you're going to be having. So why don't we go around the horn one more time with closing thoughts? You can tell anything that you want about, you know, what you're looking forward to with this project one more time, if you want, if you have anything else that's come up into your mind, or if you just have parting thoughts that you want to leave the listeners with. So I'll just call on Mira first. Mira, what are your closing thoughts? And then tell the listeners how they can find you on Twitter or any other social media that you'd like to direct them to.
Thanks, Henry. I'm just excited to, you know, be fostering more community, you know, with other dedicated leftists to explore, you know, ideas and create connections with guests. And, you know, I think it's just a wonderful opportunity for all of us to kind of grow our own knowledge and to create some really interesting intersections between the things that, you know, we've personally been working on and invested in to understand how these things all connect to each other. Yeah. And you can find me on Twitter at SnackVampire. And just a plug for the IC, you know, if you are interested in engaging in internationalism and anti-imperialism, I highly recommend that you apply. You have to be a DSA member, so, but you don't have to be a chapter member necessarily. You can also be at large. So come join us.
Yeah, fabulous. Mikey, how can the listeners, give them your final thoughts and then tell the listeners how they can find you on social media.
So final thoughts, I guess, is just another hope of what everyone can kind of bring to this show. And I'm hoping to get like, to hear more like report backs and updates on current developments and, particularly with respect to Palestine and everyone else's like organizing, just because particularly for like really important issues that don't get a lot of mainstream coverage. It's hard to keep track and know when an issue is resolved, and it's almost never like resolved, right? Pending revolution. And I think like one example is like with Red Hill, like on the 1 year anniversary, just a couple days after on November 29th, 2022, like 1300 gallons of fire suppressing foam concentrate leaked from the facility. And that's like, if it gets into the municipal water supply, that's literally like 1,000 times worse than the jet fuel. And the jet fuel is bad enough, right? Because, you know, this fire suppressing foam contains PFAS, which is like one of the worst forever chemicals, currently in the planet. It's literally in every part of the planet now. It's in all rainwater in the world. So yeah, I mean, being able to spend some time getting into not just like different aspects of history, which I think is super important, kind of part of the mission of the show generally, but also getting into a lot of developments and keeping people apprised of movement work from all the places we come from. And you can find me on Karaoke Computer, at Karaoke Computer, on all the social medias. And we're also Oahu Water Protectors and Shutdown Red Hill Mutual Aid on social media.
Yeah, fabulous. And Mikey, I know that we already talked about doing something on PFAS. I would really like, you know, if you want me to sit in with you on that, I would absolutely love to, because that's been something that I've been wanting to talk about for a while anyway. Shetta, what is your closing thoughts for the listeners and how can they find you on social media?
Well, I'm just super, super excited for this project, like taking things from online and the discourse online. It's hard to like follow and putting it into like a podcast, I think is going to be really, really fun. I'm just excited overall, to be honest. were to find me, I would first suggest following the Palestinian Youth Movement. Their shadow ban on Instagram, so you're going to have to type out their entire username, and on Twitter. And I'm not Sheda on Instagram, and I change my username every other day on Twitter because of Zionist doxing me. But that's all.
The struggles we face. Matt, what are your closing thoughts, and how can the listeners find you?
Yeah, I'm really excited for this. I'm excited to just see what everyone else does and support this collaborative effort. Excited to promote like the projects, also like just all the different projects that I'm working on and the people that I'm working on with the people that I'm working on those projects with. Having a space to have longer conversations about it is really exciting as a reflection exercise. Something else I just want to say is like, if you're listening to my stuff, you have to be doing stuff. Like, you can't just be listening and hoarding this information. That's not why I do it. Like, a big reason why I want this platform is so exciting to me is that I feel like a lot of organizers listen to it. A lot of people who are looking to get into organizing. That's why we're doing this. It's to be a resource for the work we care about so much. And yeah, that's just what I want everyone who's participating in this to have in mind as sort of a part of the guiding principles of this. Yeah. And then the other thing is that last year, my resolution was to do more art, be more creative. And I did that, but I didn't put out that much art. I finished a bunch of stuff that I'm still like working on getting out. But this year is about putting out more stuff, and putting out a bunch of these episodes to me is a check mark on that goal. So I treat each episode as a piece of art, as a creative endeavor, and as a way to cut through the barriers of language and help imagine new worlds. So you can follow up with me at on Twitter at MattXRed, MattXRed, and Instagram is my name at Matt Deitch. I'm easy to find.
Yeah, awesome. Sam, what are your closing thoughts, and how can the listeners find you?
Okay, so first of all, I just want to say I'm so excited. I am surrounded by people who are just so absolutely like brilliant and have such like valuable things to contribute, which is so cool. And for me, like, so much of my political development came from like listening to people who at first, and now I agree with everyone here, but you know, listening to people who you don't agree with, I think is so important, because you start to really like deconstruct why you think the way you do. And that was really instrumental in my political development, was like being like, wait, all these people that people tell me not to listen to, like, why? And as I started to listen to them, I realized, oh, well, now I know why I was told not to listen to them, and also I should have been listening to them. I mean, just in reference to the last conversation we had, I've heard like the phrase, and I don't know where, I was trying to Google where I heard it from, because I know it's from some text or something, about bourgeois social attitudes persisting even after socialism. So in some like hypothetical socialist future, I don't think that we're going to like, you know, be completely rid of racism or misogyny or whatever in reference to our last conversation. And that's something we have to struggle for constantly. And just having that and being aware of, you know, certain chauvinistic tendencies that are emerging and, you know, and have been emerging on like whatever you want to call it, a sensible revolutionary left. And being aware that those tendencies exist, and, you know, knowing that we have to squash them, because, you know, that doesn't just go away overnight. As if the mode of production were to change tomorrow, those attitudes would persist. So yeah, that's my closing thoughts. And you can find me on Twitter at Zuko's Mama. That's it. Thanks.
Fabulous. I know listeners are probably wondering why James has not spoken in a while. It's because James had to go to work. So he's no longer with us. He's not dead. He's just not on the call with us right now. But I will read him out. You can follow James on Twitter at Good Vibe Politique. That's Good Vibe, P-O-L-I-T-I-K. You can also find him on TikTok. I highly recommend James's TikTok. It's very hard for me to access because, you know, everything is blocked in Russia. But I do appreciate what I can see from him when I'm able to see it. You can find that at James Gets Political on TikTok. As for me, you can find me on Twitter at Huck1995. You can follow Gorilla History, the show that I co-host, at Gorilla_pod, G-U-E-R-R-I-L-L-A_pod. And we also are planning on promoting the episodes of Guerrilla Radio via the Guerrilla History Twitter account. So if you want to keep up to date on in terms of what's coming out from Guerrilla Radio on Twitter, just follow the Guerrilla History Twitter account, Guerrilla_pod, and we will keep you informed of any time that we're releasing an episode of Guerrilla Radio from any of our members of the Partisan Brigade. So on that note then, listeners, and until next time, solidarity.
Glasses from styrofoam. You want it more than a model home. Every week we plan our escape. Yeah. A little effort is all it takes.
Yeah. I fuck with autumn for the changes. My family is the foliage, the branches for the nameless. My roots as deep as holiest. I console the mothers who saw the streets as fathers, to raise a wild few who ended up amongst the scholars. Yeah, that's why I'm praying for our daughters. So they can lead us through these waters. Cause when mama's proud, she's the grace that we charter. Ambition is akin to intuition.
Saturdays, with your mind on empty, spirit on extra, body on me. Won't buy what the soul can't see. Won't touch what the heart can't read. Waiting for a cold case of basics. They just wanna see if we'll make it. Same answers, new faces. Circles round these places. Plexiglass and some styrofoam. You want it more.